Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program is brought to you by the Dairy Farm Families of Wisconsin, the Wisconsin Milk Marketing Board. Did you know that today Wisconsin produces more than 600 varieties, types, and styles of American, international style, and original cheese that win more awards than any other state or country? To learn more, visit eatwisconsincheese.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Hello, welcome to We Dig Plants on Heritage Radio Network. I'm Alice Marcus Krieg.
And I'm Carmen DeVito.
And we are collectively Groundworks, Inc. We design and build gardens in New York City and the surrounding area, and our show brings the culture to horticulture. So we have a new format. We are 1 whole hour to devote to all things budding. Our show will also be now once monthly to allow us more time to devote to research and producing the show. We have a theme running through all of this year, and the theme is zones, land and climate, from the island of Manhattan to the redwood forests to the Gulf Stream waters. Our country is huge, and we have so much diversity in land, people, weather, and climate. We want to highlight this by using the USDA map as a guide to gardening. Each show will focus on one USDA zone and the people and places that make it unique. Last month, we virtually traveled to Hawaii and Puerto Rico with Zones 12 and 13, and today we're going to Hawaii again as we examine Zone 11, A and B, with a coffee grower on the Big Island and an old friend of ours, landscaper, gardener, amazing friend, James Dreiler in Miami, who's going to talk about gardening in southern Florida.
Well, before we go into our Zone 11, I just wanted to give a shout-out to a couple of our fans.
Before we get into the zone.
Yes. I don't think we're ever going to leave Hawaii, Alice. I think every episode
I'm staying in Hawaii.
We're going to stay in zone, Hawaiian zone. But we've had lots of great comments from our fans. I just want to do a shout-out to Lauren Elizabeth Christian, who's a new gardener, just learning to garden, and she loves our show. She's from Virginia. And Beverly Gray in West Palm Beach, who's guessing she's probably Zone 10. And Judy Tableson, who's a fan in Cincinnati, who's in Zone 6. So we're really glad to hear from all the different zones. And please stay in touch with us and tell us about your zone and your gardening, and we'll try to feature it on our blog.
Sure.
Or mention you at least on the show. So a bit about Zone 11. To give some background, in 2012, the USDA, that is the U.S. United States Department of Agriculture, published an updated map that more closely reflects what the weather in the U.S. is like now. In this latest edition of the map, a complex algorithm was used to better analyze weather data from different stations. Just like the previous maps, it divides the country into different zones, which are numbered from 1 through 13 and with half zones as well. These zone numbers tell us what the average minimum temperatures are in that zone. And each zone has a 10-degree range of minimum temperatures, and each half zone has a 5-degree range. This map is what growers, gardeners, and anyone working in horticulture uses to determine what can grow where. It is a kind of guide to your patch of earth. When you buy a plant, it often lists its hardiness zone to help you decide if you can grow it where you live or if you have to bring it indoors for the winter.
So this is also called zone envy.
Yes.
For us gardeners.
Yes.
Because I often like to, in the winter, spend my time looking at the desert botanical garden, talking to my friends that have gone to the Seattle flower show, which just happened a week or so ago. It's so fun to virtually travel to other landscapes.
Yeah,
you know,
especially warmer ones.
Warmer ones.
I don't know what we're going to do when we get to zone one, Alice.
Well, we'll see what we have to talk about there. So zone 11, the cold temps range from 40 to 50 degrees in this zone on average. 11A is on the cooler side at about 43 degrees Fahrenheit average. And 11B is a little warmer at 45 degrees. So this is the orange color on the map. And there's actually not so much of it, really.
Yeah, we're looking at it here in the studio.
It's a small zone in comparison to the vast U.S. landscape. So this is parts of Miami and South Florida, Key West and the Barrier Islands, Everglades, and some spots in Hawaii. And there's one tiny spot on an island off of Anaheim, California, Catalina. Yeah. So it's really fun to go to the website, the USDA website, look at the interactive map.
It's fun.
You can zoom in and zoom out, and it's fascinating what has been put together. In fact, in our next show, next month, we're going to talk to the map maker.
Yes.
About all the research that went in and all the algorithms that are used. And why
this map matters, because it's beyond what Alice and I were just talking about. There's a lot of other institutions and individuals that use this map, and we'll share about that.
I think
next
more
time.
People should actually use this map and not deny science.
I know. Agree. And actually, you know what he said to me? They're already working on a new one.
Yeah.
Because,
of course, because of climate change, right? It is happening.
Yeah.
Sorry, people. So the average weather for Zone 11 on the Big Island, we're going to go to Hawaii right now. So we're going to go to the east side of the Big Island. It's a very wet place. It receives, on average, 3 to 5 times more rain than the United States average. November through April are the months with the most rain and cloud cover. So if you travel to the Puna region on the Big Island, you will probably see some rain and some sun. The daily average weather in Volcano Park, the air temperature and the cloud cover on an hour-by-hour basis, is that there are large differences in cloud cover throughout the day. You will have the most chance to see the sun in the morning between sunrise and 6 a.m., after which there'll be chance of clouds increasing rapidly. I feel like the weatherman. Afternoon, the sky will be an overcast cloud cover with an average of 7 from out of 10 days. So
it's high altitude.
It's high altitude,
right.
Yeah. So now that the weather stage is set, let's get on the phone with our coffee grower, Big Island Coffee Roasters, on the eastern side of the Big Island in the Puna region. So welcome, owners Kaylee and Brandon.
Hello.
Hi. Thanks for joining us.
Of course. Of course. How are you doing?
Good. Good. I'm glad you sound nice and clear, which is great. Thank you.
Excellent. Excellent.
So
You're welcome.
You guys have a really great story. Tell us how you got into coffee growing and what your background is.
Sure. So the coffee growing story, pardon me, we were actually living in Portland, Oregon at the time. We were both kind of just waiting tables. We were also avid mushroom hunters, and we were really looking to either buy a farm or potentially buy a house just in the city.
Mm-hmm.
We kind of did that, looking around for a while, to no avail. Had a very difficult time. This is also in 2009, 2010, right, the financial crisis. So
right.
It was hard to get any loans, of course, as you might imagine. So,
right.
and looking on Craigslist, I was up in the middle of the night one evening, just looking for real estate, and I came across...
Aren't we all?
right. So I was looking at real estate and saw a listing under Portland for a Hawaiian coffee farm. And I saw it, and I was like, oh, of course, this is some Craigslist scam.
Right.
But I checked out the ad, and it had a Remax agent listing and everything like that. I was like, huh, maybe this is legit. So in the morning, I showed Kelly the listing, and I was like, well, what do you think about this? And she's like, call on it. One of the biggest attractants to it, aside from the fact that it's coffee farming in Hawaii, was that it was an owner-financed property.
Right.
We were very curious, of course. So I called on it, and basically there were no signs saying not to investigate further. The real estate agent was very encouraging, and he said, he's just like, you guys sound like a perfect fit for this place. It's just owned by this friend, Bob of mine, old guy from Oklahoma. He's just ready to retire. He's done. He's 74 years old. He wants to get out of Hawaii.
Oh, my God. You found the needle in the haystack.
Exactly. Yeah. So that was really it. We came out to see the property a week later after that phone call. And it was all green lights for us. It was too good to pass up, I guess.
So how did you learn about coffee growing? Had you had any experience at least with roasting, or
did Bob show you? Did he hang around and show you what to do?
Right. Well, silly enough as it sounds, we had no experience with coffee whatsoever, neither in cultivation or roasting or anything like that. Kelly was an avid coffee drinker, and I myself, I could enjoy a good cup of coffee, but I actually wasn't a regular coffee drinker. It just wasn't a thing for me.
Mm-hmm.
But we had no experience at all. We were starting from ground zero. And luckily enough, I mean, Hawaii is actually, coffee growing is kind of, as you might imagine, a little bit of a, it's not common, but enough people do it to where the University of Hawaii has actually put out a handy book that is called Growing Coffee in Hawaii.
I found that in my research. Yes.
Perfect. Well, then, yeah, exactly. So that's all you have to do. And that was really it. I mean, and for me, too, as a farmer, just to give a little bit of background, so I worked for 2 years for a CSA in Portland just after graduating college, and that really was a life-changing experience for me, and that's what really got me, I guess, just very passionate about working outside, working with my hands, and working with plants. And so that was a huge impetus for buying a coffee farm as well, as I had just worked with a lot of vegetables before, but an orchard crop honestly sounded like a relief. Absolutely. So, we had the confidence we could figure it out, I guess, and yeah.
Okay, can you describe the land that you guys work on and where it's sited and kind of like location and why that's important to the Puna variety that you grow?
Yeah, absolutely. So we are on the east side of the Big Island, so the opposite side of Kona.
Mm-hmm.
We're on the rainy side of the island. We get about 150 to 200 inches of rain per year, which is quite a bit.
Yeah.
And we've actually, one year we were here, we've had about 400 inches.
Oh, my God.
We've had, an insane amount of rain.
That's 10 times the amount New York gets in a year.
Right.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
Yeah, it is crazy. It is. That year was, it was incredible. But, so very, very wet over here. And where we are situated, we're actually on top of lava flow that's about 500 years old and a very common practice here. In our neighborhood, there are a lot of people that grow orchids and anthuriums. So what will happen, and this is what happened with our property, it's a 3-acre lot. We're at about 1,300 feet. And basically the owner came in and on the 3 acres just bulldozed it out and flattened it. And then they laid volcanic cinder, so basically like just pumice rock, essentially, and put a 12 to 18 inch layer of that volcanic cinder across all 3 acres. And this used to be an anthurium farm. And then a blight came through in the 90s, and the owner decided to just bulldoze the anthuriums into the jungle.
Right.
Side of the property. And then he planted coffee at the tender age of 60. So our coffee grows in volcanic cinder on top of lava flow. We don't have soil at all. It's almost like hydroponic growing. We've got about a 2-inch layer of organic matter that's built up over the years, and there's ground cover. That's basically just this little shrubby grass that's more or less sterile. It just kind of spreads very gently. But we've got nice ground cover, very thin layer of humus, but it's otherwise just a bunch of rocks.
And I'm assuming this isn't shade-grown coffee then, right? It's out...
Yeah, it's out in full sun.
Okay.
However, I sort of like to argue a little bit just by virtue of how much rain we have and mm-hmm. cloud cover where we are, that it's it's not shade-grown in the sense of, there was once jungle here. That
yeah,
was
yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Taken away, right? Yeah, yeah. It's definitely, yeah, full sun.
So can you speak to, I think most people, I don't want to focus on this, but I think most people understand Kona coffee. Everybody, you know, it's like synonymous with Hawaii, right? So yeah. Tell us about Puna and the differences.
Sure, sure. So let's see. I think it's mostly all kind of rooted in just the environmental circumstances,
mm-hmm.
and playing a part of that too. The environment obviously dictates a little bit of the varieties that we choose to grow. So over in Kona, Tipica in Hawaii is by far the most commonly grown variety of coffee, and that's because it actually does very, very well here. So Tipica is all over the place, and it does beautifully over in Kona. However, on our side of the island, at least in my field and other fields that I see amongst other Puna coffee growers, there's another variety called Katura and Katuai. Those are both very, very closely related. Those two handle the rain and the intense rain, I should say, and the cloud cover much, much better.
Okay.
Yeah, so basically it's very similar to wine with coffee, right? It's terroir, all the environmental circumstances that kind of go into making the characteristics what they are. So over on our side, yeah, Tipica can grow here, no problem. Actually, lower elevations, places with a little bit more soil tend to do a little bit better with Tipica as well here in Puna. But by and large, what makes Puna coffee is very much the weather and obviously the soil too, or lack thereof.
Right.
Yeah.
So the average person's cup of coffee is Arabica, right?
Yeah.
That's
actually,
like the most commonly grown world variety.
Yeah, Yep, definitely so. So all of the varieties that are grown in Hawaii, they're all Arabica. And when I say things like Tipica or Katura or Katuai, those are subspecies of Arabica.
Okay.
Those are all still Arabica.
Okay. And how would you describe the Puna coffee in terms of taste? How does it compare to...
I wish I could be tasting right now as we're talking.
Hint, hint, Brandon.
Right. I feel terrible now. I'm like, wow, I definitely did not prepare you too very well. I should have sent you coffee to brew while we were talking. I was thinking about it even more. So let's see.
Use your words, Brandon.
I'll do my best.
Okay.
So with Kona coffee, we find that it's generally a fairly delicate, mellow, nice and just subtle, sweet, balanced coffee profile. And I know that those are all kind of very vague and they mean something to different people.
Right. Subjective, right.
Sure.
Very subjective, of course. But in comparison to, say, Puna coffee is pretty much, for me, easy to spot on a cupping table if we're tasting coffees from around Hawaii. It's really hard to describe. I've heard different words used when cupping with people that I think are work well. So some people describe it as sort of like a musk. Like sandalwood, sort of like some people believe it or not are like, oh, this tastes like Indian food, or like evokes that sort of response. Like there's a savory sweet quality to it.
Okay.
And it's definitely a little bit more, I guess. Manly was the other word that somebody used that I thought was really funny, but also kind of applicable. I was like, okay, I get what you mean in terms of like this musk. Not musty, not like moldy, because that's a defect problem, right?
Right,
but
right.
We're just talking about like it's got a little bit more umph to it. It's earthen. Another friend basically described it as like it tastes like it being in the bake shop. Like there's molasses and baking spices, but then there's also like these savory elements to it as well. So
okay.
Yeah, sorry, I threw a whole bunch of words out there.
It's actually very descriptive.
It is, and also the different opinions. I mean, it'd be fun to go to a cupping event, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
Like taste. Does it lend itself to the high roasting of, like, for espresso? Brandon, do you think that would, like, burn out that coffee?
That is actually a great question you asked. So I think that is another distinction between Puna coffee and Kona coffee in particular, not necessarily everywhere else, but... Yeah, so Kona coffee I've found, we have found, does not do very well with darker roasts, or at least it kind of loses a lot. And the Puna coffee, for me, generally tends to hold up well to a slightly darker roast.
Okay.
I think it excels even at, you know, medium light roast, whatever else. But yeah, it definitely maintains some really nice characters as you roast it a little bit darker. And so, yeah, for espresso, it definitely can work out.
That's good to know. I recently came back from Costa Rica, which is another big coffee producing place.
Right.
And I had some of the best, smoothest coffee I ever had.
Mm-hmm.
And I brought some back, and it didn't hold up well to being used in an espresso maker. It wasn't right for that kind of coffee brewing, you know?
Interesting.
It was very interesting.
I wonder, Brian, would the humidity here in New York, there's a lot of humidity in Costa Rica, but or actually maybe the dryness.
Yeah, I just thought maybe the roast, it just wasn't right because it did not taste like it did in Costa Rica, you know? So I said, this isn't made for.
Maybe it's the water.
It could be the
like bagels.
The water, yes, exactly. So it was just interesting. So I'm going to have to get some Puna because I drink. That's what I drink.
Yeah.
You know, and I love when you have a good espresso roast, it's like, you know.
It makes a difference.
Can you describe the process of growing coffee horticulturally? Like, we've talked a little bit about soil and the kind of substrate that it grows in. But talk about, if you could, fertilizing and pests and harvest and kind of the, like, year-long
The general sort of schedule, I guess, of growing it, what it's like. Yeah, so coffee is fairly low maintenance, of course, just like any other orchard crop. The harvest season is really the busiest time. So our harvest season, basically, like right now, we're just into a flowering, and from flower until fruit maturation is anywhere between 7.5 to about 9 months. It just really depends on the weather. We have a flowering, and then seven and a half months later, it starts to ripen. And throughout that period, that 7 or 8 months right there, it's more or less just maintenance with fertilization. And usually, there is some form of pest control, and there are obviously many different ways to go about it here in Hawaii, actually everywhere else in the world, but it's sort of a newer thing here in Hawaii. We have this thing called the coffee berry borer. CBB for short.
Oh.
And so how we mitigate the impact of that is we actually use biological fungicides. So it's called Bovaria bassiana is the strain of fungus that we use to manage it. So that works out great. That's a nice organic solution to the problem. And otherwise, if there are any other issues for us, I'll sometimes use an organic copper spray to keep out a lot of the fungal problems that we'll have.
Right.
And otherwise, that's fairly it as far as the just growing season management. And then the harvest season, right? It's just all hand harvested.
Wow.
So it's a lot of picking with the hands for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, quite a bit of work. Very labor-intensive crop when it comes to the harvesting part.
Do you bring on labor for that?
Yes, absolutely.
Can I come?
Yeah, sure.
So what time of the year is that?
That usually starts in August, late August, early September, and we'll finish up sometimes as early as Christmas or even a little bit before. Sometimes it will extend as late as March. It really depends on the weather. So the cooler the weather, the slower the maturation of the coffee, and hence the elongation of the harvest season.
Mm-hmm.
Brandon, I have a question about the harvesting. Do the berries harvest all? I mean, do they mature all at once, or is it like lemons, where they like, you know,
where it's like a couple at a time,
and you know, you have to keep on picking, or do they kind of mature within like a 2 or 3 week period?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, by and large, for us, where we're located, the ripening is pretty uneven.
Mm-hmm.
Over the years, we've been lucky enough, I should say, with the weather, because obviously the ripeness is all determined by the flowering cycle. And the flowering cycle is all dependent on the weather. So with us, since we have so much rain throughout the year, we have lots of little flowering sessions, but there's certainly a cluster of when we're going to get flowering. And so how coffee works is if there's basically about a 6 to 8 week quote-unquote drought period, meaning that it gets less than half of its usual annual amount in that 6 to 8 weeks, then the next time it rains or the next rains that come in, that sparks the flowering.
Hmm.
So for us, we've actually been really lucky the last 3 years or so where we've had very determined dry periods, January and February, which is right after the harvest.
Mm-hmm.
And then that time is convenient enough for lots and lots of flowers to pop up once it starts raining again in March. And in fact, that's actually just what happened this week. It's been really dry January and February, and just yesterday the rain really started hammering down, and it looks like it's going to rain for the next week straight. So we're getting a massive flowering right now.
Wow.
But otherwise, yeah, otherwise it's pretty uneven. The first couple of years we were here, harvesting was, I will be totally honest with you, it was terrible. It sucked. It was torture.
Yeah.
It was so, we started harvesting in late August, and we harvested until April.
Wow.
It was just really, really, really long and drawn out. So, yeah, it's just, it's not terrible, right? Because the flip side of that is when you get this powerful flowering in a short period, it means that you have a lot of coffee to take off the trees within a small period, too. And so there are definite trade-offs there, but I personally really like it when it kind of all comes on at one.
Mm-hmm.
It just increases the efficiencies with all the processing.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Yeah.
So then you do the roasting there, and you bag it, and you market it.
You sell directly, right?
We do everything on site here at our farm. So, it doesn't need to go anywhere. It doesn't need to leave our hands at all.
Right. So tell me about yield. What's a good yield? What's a bad yield?
So what a good yield is, in general... Well,
fair to Midland?
sorry, what's that?
Fair to Midland?
what Hawaii considers a good yield is basically 10,000 pounds of cherry, that's the coffee fruit, per acre per year.
Huh.
Now, that's really good. I actually don't know... That those numbers were kind of come to by a lot of research over in Kona in the 50s and 60s.
Okay.
And that's certainly achievable over there. I mean, Kona definitely has a great environment for productivity, especially with Typica. Typica thrives over there, and it does really well. In fact, some of the farmers that we work with, they get 12 to 15,000 pounds of cherry per acre, so a whole bunch. However, over on the east side over here, and also in Kau, which is the southern district and sort of basically just situated between us and Kona, I don't know of any farmer that has actually ever hit that amount. We've averaged about, I'd say the best we have done is 7,500 pounds from our own field, and that was an exciting year.
Mm-hmm.
But that's usually as much as I've heard is about 7,000 to 8,000 pounds per acre. The average is actually pretty low. It's about 4,000 to 5,000 pounds.
Okay.
So, yeah.
Yeah.
About half of what, quote unquote, it should be. But,
right.
Yeah.
So tell me, you've won several awards, right? You're really, like, bringing this to the forefront.
Yeah. We've really been, we've been surprised, and we've been really fortunate with, apparently tasting really good. So, in 2013 was really a great crop. That year was,
Okay.
I think I was just about, I'm sort of sorry, I was second-guessing my word choice there. I was going to sound very much like Trump, which I didn't want to do. It was a huge success.
Huge.
Success. Huge
bigly.
Success.
Bigly success.
Yeah, the best coffee ever. sorry, couldn't help but to poke a little bit of fun right now.
Exactly. You got to laugh.
So in 2013, we were kind of on a roll. So we submitted our coffee to a review board. Actually, it's very much like Wine Spectator, equivalent to Coffee World, called Coffee Review. We sent in our Peaberry coffee and got a 93 out of 100 with that, and that was in March. And then in July, we won the statewide cupping competition.
Oh.
Hawaii every year puts on a cupping competition, and everyone who grows coffee is free to submit it. And so we took first place in the state with that, which was really awesome because nobody had really paid attention or heard of Puna coffee before. So
we were
definitely a surprise.
That's awesome. Congratulations.
Yeah. Oh, thank you. Yeah, that was a really exciting moment. And then a little bit after that, we submitted another coffee of ours. It's a Yellow Katura varietal. We submitted that to Coffee Review, and that got a 94 out of 100. And then later on that year, Coffee Review does this thing where they do a top 30 coffees for the entire year, and Honeydew La Cotura was one of the top coffees. It got number 19 in the world out of, like, over 400 different coffees tasted. So, yeah, that was really a great year. A lot of awards then, and then we've actually had subsequent awards since then too. So it's been kind of a fun ride. We've been on a roll.
Where else is the Puna variety grown in the world?
So Puna is actually only grown. It's like Kona coffee is. Local only, exactly.
Okay.
Yeah, you can't grow Puna coffee anywhere outside of Puna.
Oh, okay. I thought maybe other places in the world would have, you know.
No, I guess they're kind of like what the French and the Italians do with their cheeses and
their Bordeaux.
You can't call it Puna unless it's grown there, right?
Okay.
Is that the deal, Brandon?
That's exactly right. Yeah, we don't have any special variety of coffee that only exists here or anything like that. No, it's just a terroir sort of designation.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
And are more acres being devoted to it now, to Puna? Is it starting to sort of grow?
I would say very, very
slowly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, there have been a few people, obviously, since we've lived here, that farmers that we work with that we'll do some processing for and stuff like that. But by and large, no, the growth is not by any means, I think, even remarkable whatsoever. It's just slow. It's sort of, you know, people, the real estate over here is relatively very inexpensive. So a lot of folks like to come out here because it's Hawaii. It's beautiful, right?
Yeah.
But it's also affordable. And so people will oftentimes buy, you know, a 2 to 3 acre lot, and then they'll have like an acre of coffee or something like that.
So oh, okay.
There are a lot of hobbyists, I would say, but not much in the way of commercial cultivation.
Mm-hmm. So do you get any government assistance at all as a farmer, or are you strictly off the government radar?
At this point now, we are basically off the government radar.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, there are some sort of, I guess,
subsidy programs,
farm expenses. Yeah, like Kelly wrote a grant for a we have a coffee grader that we got in 2013 as well, and she wrote a grant for that, which was great because it's a super helpful piece of equipment over here for product differentiation. So if a farmer wants to say, and in Hawaii we have several different sort of classifications of green coffee, and so to be able to separate out your crop into things like with your pea berry or your extra fancy, which is the largest bean size, the grader does that. It will sort the coffee out by size, and it will allow a farmer to differentiate their products for different markets if they choose to do so.
Oh, cool.
So that was a really helpful tool to get out here, and it's the only one that's on this side of the island. So that was the other big help, too, is that Kona is where most of the industry is located. So that's where all of the big mills and the processors and the equipment is. And so we wanted to service farmers over here to be able to have that same opportunity without having to drive over to Kona.
Right. Yeah. So what's the future of the business for you? What's your 5-year plan, Brandon?
That is a great question. Do you have any answers for me?
Keep growing, right?
right. Yeah, so we are, to be quite blunt, we are pretty unsure about exactly where we're going to be going. At this point right now, I can't say that we have farm expansion in the works at all. A lot of what we're doing as far as just business goes is actually quite a bit in the way of services and just general wholesale.
Mm-hmm.
We have 2 acres of coffee, which is certainly not very much, to be quite honest.
Yeah.
So we buy a lot of coffee from around Hawaii because we like to show off that diversity, that terroir, and say, look, this, you know, Hamakua coffee is going to taste different than Puna, obviously, then it's going to taste different than Ka'u or Kona. So we really like to continue to push that because, honestly, not many companies in Hawaii are doing that, and we think that that's kind of the really fun thing about Hawaiian coffee is that we have all of these different little microclimates available to us, especially on the Big Island. So we really want to keep promoting that. And
that's wise. I mean, because you're focusing on the marketing.
Uh-huh.
You know, you're not intending to become the biggest, coffee producer on your side of the island.
No, it's a niche. It's a niche product.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And we think that that's just kind of where coffee is, where it will help further for Hawaiian coffee, just because I think when people hear Kona coffee, people think that Kona coffee is just all Hawaiian coffee, and there's really a lot of different places where coffee is grown in Hawaii. So the marketing end for sure. And I think that was, honestly, like, I love doing the farm work, But the reality is, it's hard to make a living with just the farm link, farm work, for sure. And we're not independently wealthy, so we have to kind of follow the money a little bit and grow in accordance with that. But that was also, in our opinion, too, one of the weak spots for the coffee industry in Hawaii was, like, the marketing was just behind.
Wasn't
reaching future generations, wasn't reaching younger generations at all, or even, like, you know, folks in that are our age, like in their mid-30s or something like that. It was basically, like, a lot of consumers for Hawaiian coffee tend to be older, and that's not a problem. It's just we need to make it approachable and appealing for a younger market if the Hawaiian coffee industry has any ability for longevity in the future.
Yeah, and to be able to compete internationally.
Right.
Absolutely.
Right.
Absolutely. So, yeah, it's justifying the price through quality and telling a compelling story because, you know, we when it comes down to it, is this specialty coffee craze is definitely built up, you know, in the last 5-10 years.
Of course.
You know, Hawaii is a great landmark to go to because we speak English here, we use the dollars, it's very, very easy tourism, so to speak, right?
Yeah,
I encourage
yeah.
people to, obviously, if they're coffee lovers, and go to another coffee-producing country, by all means. It would be a fantastic experience, but if you want to just kind of dip a toe in and see coffee and just understand it more, I mean, Hawaii is the place that you can go. It's the easiest to get to and the easiest logistically to work with, and I think there's just a huge opportunity there for education, but also connection with coffee drinkers and coffee lovers.
Well, you have made me a convert, and I will be on the next plane. I'll be there soon. And I, you know, Carmen and I sell bags of small soil, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like,
yes.
You're preaching to the choir. We sell soil called Brooklyn Blend, mm-hmm. right? Because in our garden design business, we realized the niche that was needed in a small bag of soil versus a 50-pound bag of soil for the urban environment. So, you know, like,
we mixed up our own soil, our own compost, and our own potting soil. And it sold like gangbusters because New York City apartments are small, and you might only need a 10-pound bag, and you don't, or even a 5-pound bag,
right?
And you don't want the 50-pound bag,
right?
So you're finding that niche, you know,
that specialty niche, and it is all about marketing and you know, promotion and our job as people involved with plants and gardens and orchards and food is to stimulate the younger generation. So
exactly.
You know, absolutely.
Thank you for everything that you do.
And
I really wish you great success with the Puna variety.
And Brandon, share your website and where people can find it.
Oh yeah, sure. So it's just bigislandcoffeeroasters.com.
Okay.
Easy to get, easy to remember, and I will be placing an order later today, I think.
thank you so much, Brandon.
Give me a holler if you have any questions at
all. Thanks for joining us, and thanks for helping us understand the coffee business a little bit.
Absolutely. Thanks so much for having me on.
Okay. So stay on the line, folks. We are going to take a break, and then we're going to come back and talk about some tropical landscapes in southern Florida. Thanks.
Today's program is brought to you by the Wisconsin Milk Marketing Board. Wisconsin produces the world's best cheese, period. Why? Lush grasslands, glacial water supply, fourth-generation cheesemakers, combining old-world tradition with the new ideas and highest standards. The very best milk. What do you think of when you think of Wisconsin cheese? For me, I think cheese curds. Delicious, fresh cheese curds or deep-fried cheese curds. Cheese curds literally any way, anytime, any place. I think about Andy Hatch and Upland's Cheese Company, the operation behind the Pleasant Ridge Reserve cheese that's literally America's most awarded cheese. I think of the deliciously stinky Limburger and its long-storied history. I think about Raleigh's Dumbarton Blue, a perfect blend of English-style cheddar and notes of blue. I think of Emmy Roth's Grand Cru Sirchois, which was named 2016's World Champion at the World Championship Cheese Contest. Wisconsin is like the world champion of cheese, and once you start reading the list of cheeses made in Wisconsin on their website, you can see why. The Wisconsin Milk Marketing Board is a nonprofit organization funded entirely by Wisconsin's dairy farm families. read more at eatwisconsincheese.com. And as soon as you're done listening to this podcast, eat Wisconsin cheese. It's a no-brainer.
Hi, welcome back. Today we're talking about the USDA map, and we're talking about Zone 11 in particular. We just left Hawaii. We talked about coffee, and for the break, we went to Wisconsin and talked about some cheese.
I just suddenly had a cheese
craving. I know.
Craving.
I feel so hungry.
That's so wrong.
Like weather and food.
Well, so, now we're back on the mainland.
Yes.
The U.S. mainland, kind of. We have as our guest today James Giler, an old friend from our Horticultural Society of New York days.
He bailed out of New York.
Very wise man.
He went to the beach. There's some beach music.
That's
for
what
us.
James hears on a daily basis. I spend some time with James. Often when I go down to Florida, I try to check in with him, and he always takes me on some unexpected adventure that I really love. James lives in Miami. James, are you with us on the line?
I am.
Hi.
Hey.
Hi.
How are you doing?
Great. Great.
Good. So we want to talk about Zone 11, South Florida, the Keys, and about agriculture and horticulture in the state of Florida. Your experience with it. You went from Zone 7.
Right, on the Lower East Side.
On the Lower East Side, to this warmer, more wonderful, fertile place.
So humid, dense, tropical, colorful.
Tell us about that transition, James, what that was like, and how you kind of adapted to the new climate.
Yeah.
Well, you know, the most amazing thing about Florida being a tropical, one of the only tropical places on the mainland, is that everything that you think would grow here really well is extremely limited by the soil. So when you dig into South Florida soil, you're not really even digging into soil. You're going in at about a quarter of an inch, and then you're hitting what we call oolitic limestone. So, you know, the first thing about, you know, gardening in Florida is most of your vegetables are going to be in raised beds.
Mm-hmm.
You just can't dig into the ground and plant a garden. You need to you just have to have a chipping hammer, you know, which is like a jackhammer, just to go in 5, 6, sometimes 12 inches to take out that oolitic limestone.
Oh, wow.
You know, which is the substrate of South Florida all the way down to the Keys. Occasionally you hit sand deposits, but mostly you're going to be hitting limestone. And everything needs to be raised. So that means the key to gardening here is, you know, is compost and mulch and lots of it. When you see those amazing orchards in Homestead right before you leave the mainland for the Keys, you see these incredible avocado orchards and mango orchards and lychee orchards, and you think, wow, everything just is just a fertile plain, you know. And what they have to do is they blast rows out with dynamite. And then they start planting from there. Now, of course, the oolitic limestone is extremely porous, so you're always going to get well-drained soils. But the other problem, too, is being oolitic limestone, it is extremely alkaline.
Right.
So now you come back again, and you start, when you think of the tomato crops of South Florida, which is our, you know, winter crop here, for example. I mean, there's a lot that goes into just maintaining a slightly acidic pH when you're basically farming on pure limestone. So those are these key ingredients that make, you know, farming in the tropics here extremely challenging. And yet everything does seem to grow.
Yeah. It seems, I think you're right. I think people get the sense that Florida is like one of our bread baskets, or fruit baskets.
As if it's the California Valley.
Yeah.
Right.
And they just, you know, somebody just put a plow in there and turned over the soil, and then it's good to go. But if anybody goes to the Keys, like a lot of people associate Florida beaches with the beaches of Miami and
those
with
big white beautiful.
But
right.
if you go to the Keys, as James, you know, you've gone many times and I've gone a few times, you will see what Florida is made out of. You will see the limestone and the coral mm-hmm. that is like the underpinning that you're talking about, you know?
Yeah, and you know, and that's basically what your, you know, that's what Florida was based on. It was just the rising and falling of seas over millions of years, which exposed these trillions and trillions of little crustaceans, cementing mm-hmm. their little limestone, you know, calcium carbonate bodies together into this, you know, sedimentary sheet, which is what Florida is, and that's what we're growing into. But you know, on the other hand, it's just I'm still amazed sometimes to see how easy it is to grow other things, and you know, and you're always balancing a really good crop with, you know, a following year of poor crops, because there's so many other kinds of diseases or insects or little animals that make themselves known, which when you didn't think, you know, one year you have this amazing crop of papayas, and papayas grow in a little tiny bit of soil, and you throw a seed down and it pops up in your, you know, through your compost, and papaya everywhere, and yet all of a sudden, you know, there's this mealybug that decides to attack every single papaya you have, or you know, there's a rust now that's attacking a lot of the papayas. So you know, you're constantly shifting from, you know, kind of one set of problems to the next in this effort to produce really good food, really great fruit, really great tropical fruit, and then of course you want your winter vegetables. And then your summer crops too,
right?
Because even though it's very, very hot, you know, in the summer there are things that we can be growing and you know still producing food. So that's our winter. You know, a lot of people just let the land rest in the summer.
And let's not talk. Let's not forget about the iguanas.
Yeah.
You know, that's a pest that we don't have in New York.
Yeah.
That my parents discovered in Florida when they tried to have a raised vegetable garden. That they
right.
had to fence off. They had to protect against.
So it's the pigeon of the South.
Yes. I guess you could right. describe it like that.
Yeah.
These iguanas are just they're yeah. ruthless. They'll eat anything, pretty much.
So.
Yeah.
James, can you tell us, let's talk a little bit about the weather pattern in southern Florida and Key West, like an average day, because when I've been there, it was always like there was that late afternoon rainstorm, right? Can you talk about that?
Yeah, you know, and it's changed dramatically. You know, there used to be this time, especially through the spring, where it would rain every single day for 20 minutes.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And that just doesn't happen anymore. There's a lot more erratic weather patterns going on. But in general, you have a dry season and a wet season. And the wet season is extremely high humidity. Very rarely will you get any temperatures exceeding 100 degrees. Generally, it's going to be in the late 80s, early 90s.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, your 60 to 80% precipitation, high humidity, which brings in, you know, some of the problems that you'd expect, you know, which is bacteria and wilting disease and lots of powdery mildew and, you know, all these kinds of, you know, moldy conditions in high, wet, hot temperature. And then in the winter, you don't have that kind of humidity. It's very dry. There's very little rain. In fact, you can go 3 or 4 months without rain, but you get wind.
Mm-hmm.
So the wind comes in, and the wind, of course, you know, wicks out the water from your plants.
Right.
So you have to, you know, things dry extremely, extremely fast,
mm-hmm.
Especially when you have this kind of very light, loose soil. Very little, you know, it's still a very sandy soil. You know, you don't have any clay deposits, which kind of retains moisture. That's why you need so much compost
mm-hmm.
and mulch.
Mm-hmm.
But it's the wind that's kind of excessive through the spring, And in the winter, our winter months right now, you know, on a typical day, the wind will pick up in the late afternoon. But in general, it's really just a question of keeping things watered.
Wow. Whenever I have gone to Southern Florida, the color is what you immediately notice when you step off of the plane. You know, it's red and it's verdant and it's so striped and, you know, palm trees. And tell us about some of the plants that, because you also do some landscaping as well as food growing. Tell us about some of the plants you use in the landscape and, you know, some of the qualities that you search for.
Well, you know, I have a very narrow palate. My palate is natives, because what happened is over the last 60, 70 years, as, you know, as development, you know, South Florida became completely developed, you know, except for patches here and there. And then, of course, the national parks and some of the state parks and the national park, the Everglades, of course, takes up, you know, is really the last natural area of South Florida that's kind of intact. And that runs into Cypress.
Right.
National Park as well. So, you know, what you have is this intense suburban development. Most of the plants coming in are from Brazil, and they're from Costa Rica, and they're from,
right.
Mauritius. They're from the South Pacific. I mean, there's over 400 mm-hmm. varieties of palms coming from all over the world. And, mm-hmm. and then you have all these other kinds of flowering plants from, you know, hibiscus and, you know, and so what it's done is it's displaced this native natural environment that so many other creatures depend on, and that kind of destroys the whole feeling of what Florida was all about.
Mm-hmm.
So my whole goal is to put natives back into the landscape, whether it's suburban, urban, rural. If I'm asked to design a project, if it's not edible, it's going to be native.
So
and
tell
there's
me,
so many amazing
yeah, tell,
native
tell
plants.
Me about those. Tell me about some of the natives to Florida.
Well, you know, there's a group of plants. They're an understory tree that you can use as a hedge. Now, let me give you one example, is that everyone started planting, you know, these ivy, these ficus hedges.
Right.
You know, which is really a tree, but anyway, they were able to clone them extremely easily and very cheaply. So every landscaper used ficus hedges, and the ficus hedge became susceptible to whitefly. So now they have to go out and they use extremely
toxic,
you know, volatile
nasty,
chemicals and pesticides to control the whitefly. And then kids, of course, run through the hedges, and I've seen that on many occasions.
Mm-hmm.
Right after the guy leaves the property with his hazmat suit on, you know, like the family pulls up in the BMW, and the kids run out and they start running their hands through the hedges. And I'm thinking, I don't know if they should be doing that.
Yeah.
But so, you know, so we look at a class of trees and understory trees that substitute for these hedges, and one of those, one of my favorites, is in the stopper family. Well, when I say stopper, it's not the correct Latin family, but it's a group of plants we call stoppers. There's a white stopper that smells really funky. The leaf is almost, some people think it smells like marijuana. Some people think it smells like, you know, kind of like a spunk, like a funny fertilizer. But it's very, you know it when you smell it.
Mm-hmm.
There's the Simpson stopper. There's a red stopper, a red berry stopper, and the stoppers got their name because when Europeans first came to Florida and they had got diarrhea, the native Indians, the Seminoles, showed them how to brew a tea using these different leaves and berries from stoppers, and that kind of stopped them up.
Oh, okay. Do you
yeah.
Can you recall right now any of those of the Latin names of these plants?
Well, it's in the Eugenia family.
Eugenia, okay.
E-U-G-E-N-I-E, Eugenia
yeah.
family.
Yeah.
And then the Simpson stopper, which is one of my favorites, has a very aromatic leaf and a very aromatic flower with a berry that birds are very attracted to. And then the bark is kind of a reddish, kind of beautiful, thin, reddish, gray bark that's almost looks like muscle wood. The Simpson stopper is not in the Eugenia family. I think it's in a, and I can't recall off the top of my head right now. But, I mean, there's just this whole amazing array of different large trees, understory trees, shrubs, grasses.
Also, the native palm is a very sweet palm as well, James, right? The palmetto?
Well, there's a number of native palms. I mean, you have the saw palmetto, which people use for a... medicinal purposes.
Right, mm-hmm. Yes.
And then you have what's called the thatch palm, and then even the royal palm is native to Florida.
Yeah, those are beautiful palms that I think I associate the palmetto, the saw palmetto with Florida. Like when I think of native Florida plants, that's what I think of, you know?
Yeah.
Right. And you'll find that as an understory to the Dade County pine, or what we call slash pine.
Yeah.
And the slash pine was an amazing pine because it's termite resistant. So even my house, which was built in 1936, is built out of Dade County pine.
Oh, cool.
One of the few houses in the neighborhood that's still wood.
You mean it's not cinder block and stucco?
Yeah, not cinder block and stucco, yeah.
No, well, James lives in the White House.
La Casa Blanca.
His house looks like a mini White House.
Oh, really?
It's so funny.
But it's wood.
No, but it's white.
Uh-huh.
So they call it, like, your neighbors call it La Casa Blanca, right, James?
Yeah, La Casa Blanca. That's what it's known in the neighborhood.
So let's talk a little bit also about hurricanes. Like, you can't talk about Southern Florida without hurricanes.
Yeah.
And Gulf Stream influences on the plant material.
Right. Well, you know, here's the funny thing. I moved here in 2008. It's now 2016, and I have yet to really experience my first hurricane. You know, we did have Matthew, and on the day of Matthew, I took my kids to the beach, and they were swimming in the water with all the surfers.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, it was that was...
I actually really like hurricane
season.
Storm.
But what people do generally is that before the hurricane, you know, of course, there's massive tree pruning everywhere. Mm-hmm. And that's where I go back to natives, because I see a lot of trees that were brought in, like they're beautiful, the poinciana trees, the jacaranda trees, amazing, beautiful flowering trees, but they're very brittle, and they come down in hurricanes, you know. So I go back to, you know, the live oak or the gumbo limbo, mm-hmm. or, you know, kind of larger trees that create canopies that are going to be less susceptible, because every tree, depending on the severity of the storm and how it hits the tree, what kind of wind shear you have, I mean, these things that all affect the tree. But in general, you know, we look at also some of the large fruit trees in South Florida, like mangoes get very big and avocados get extremely big. They have to be pruned. So there's a lot of management for hurricanes prior to hurricane season. So we know when hurricane season is coming, and that's when all the tree companies are getting extremely busy. But, you know, some of your big street trees, mahogany is an amazing native street tree. But what people like to do, you know, they went out and they planted black olives after Hurricane Andrew, thinking that, okay, this will recreate the canopy in some of the, you know, wealthier neighborhoods. But the banyan trees, which is in the ficus group and family, you know, they're very susceptible to wind throw during a hurricane. But in general, you know, that's why if you have that native palette, there's no reason why you need all of these exotic trees and plants, except that, you know, there was an industry that
pushed
was
for
developed
it, promoted it,
based
right.
on tissue culture and cloning and accessibility.
Right. And it's what people that's what people associate with the tropics. I mean, you think about going to Florida, and I was just there a couple weeks ago, and you just think of the
oleanders and hibiscus.
Yes, and
croton and, you know,
yes.
all that, like,
right.
yeah,
right.
it's too much of it, you know?
Yeah.
Are you...
and badly used.
I take pictures of houses where I'm like, oh, this is, you know, I mean, there's not a lot of applications in New York, obviously, for the plant material that's used in Florida in landscapes. But the concepts are the same, you know, symmetry or asymmetry and structure. And actually, one of my favorite houses that I've been to has mostly desert-like plants. Mm-hmm. You know, they
there's
have
a lot of succulents also.
Yeah, a lot of it's a dry garden. They don't have to irrigate it mm-hmm. at all.
Aquascaping.
Yeah. Right. So, have you been to the John Birch, Hugh Birch State Park in Fort Lauderdale? That is like the only place in Fort Lauderdale that hasn't been developed, James. And that's where I saw some of the plants that you're talking about. Because everywhere else, like you said, is completely...
It's so suburban.
It's been completely been developed, you know? So there's very few pockets left. And I'm really, really gratified to see you, you know, bringing those natives back.
Yeah, and I think that's really, you know, looking forward, mm-hmm. I mean, more and more developers and counties are requiring people when they establish a new home to get their certification of occupancy, they have to have a number of natives in their landscape.
Great.
So, you know, that is changing because people see the importance of it, not just because of its impact on pollinators and other animals, and just on the what is the spirit and culture and, you know, you know, that's part of the natural history of a place, but mm-hmm. it's also because these plants are less, you know, during droughts, when we did have a drought in Florida,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
There was, you know, they are less demanding of water, and they are less liable to be thrown across the county lines in a hurricane.
Yeah, exactly. So.
Is there much foodscaping or any of like, are people getting into growing more edibles in their landscape as well, James? That's becoming really popular up here.
Yes, and it is. And I do a lot of work. People call me and say, you know, I want to have my backyard. I mean, if you could just see where I am right now at somebody's house, that's the whole backyard is basically an edible, edible landscape. And then, of course, there's the elderly couple who are, you know, gardening in their front yard, and then they get ticketed by the, you know, that particular municipality because you're not allowed to be growing food in your front yard.
Right.
You know, so there's those two things going on. But yes, people, I mean, almost every, you know, I don't want to say every house on a particular block, but, you know, every other house is going to have a major fruit tree. I mean, mm-hmm. their shade is going to be a mango tree or an avocado tree. I've seen, you know, my whole block has a median strip of tamarind trees.
Oh, nice.
You know, so the fruit trees are really, zapatilla, sapote, you know, coconut palms,
mm-hmm.
All of these things are part of that Florida landscape. So it's really an integration of edibles into even the more traditional landscape.
And they're beautiful, actually. They're beautiful.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And it's, Florida's so weird because you have this very specialized environment, and then you have, like we were just talking about, you have Homestead, which is like the largest grower of ornamental tropicals.
Yes.
For commerce.
Yes.
It's such a weird place because here they are growing all those exotics, mm-hmm. you know, and a lot of people are decorating and using them in the landscape. So it's really great, the work that you're doing. And it's nice to talk about Florida natives. Nobody talks about that. All they think of is Croton. Croton, 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 you know?
And most of those Crotons, they're going out to those homestead growers, those major nurseries. That's all Home Depot. That's all going out to Home Depot all across the Southeast.
Exactly.
And to the islands. So it's almost, you know, a lot of these nurseries, a lot of their stuff goes to resorts.
Right.
Out in, you know, the Caribbean or Puerto Rico. I mean, all of every major hotel, you know, in the Caribbean buys their plants from you know, these nurseries, and there's only a few specialty nurseries. And in fact, when you're all down here next time, we can do a tour of some of the specialty native plant nurseries in Homestead.
That would be really fun to go to.
Yeah, that would be great.
Are they old mom and pop shops? They must be.
They're family owned. Uh-huh. And they're in beautifully landscaped settings, old, you know, limestone walls and grottos, and you know, and there are people who are, you know, these are true horticulturists. They go all around to throughout the Caribbean, to the Keys, Central America, collecting seeds, and they take the seeds back, and they're actually trying to, you know, preserve the remaining flora of these quickly disappearing landscapes. I mean, there's one tree we have here in the Keys called the Biscayne ash. It's an interesting tree, very thorny. But, you know, it has a very interesting shape to it. But they thought it was extinct in the Keys, and they found a grove, not just here, but on Virginia Key as well.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a few growers with nurseries, and they started collecting the seed. And now, you know, by putting it back into the landscape, we're actually ensuring that these trees, you know, survive well into the future.
Yeah.
I mean, this is, you know, there's very few native forests in the Keys, of course,
right.
A few little parks. But, you know, so these plants have to ingratiate themselves in the human-made landscape for their own survival.
Don't we all?
Well, James, thanks
exactly.
again for being on the show.
Thanks for jumping in and helping us decipher Florida. Florida's flora, right.
And if you come up to New York, you've got to come and say hi. I know you're not likely to do that anytime soon. But
not at least until the summer.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Well, you know, get in touch and we can hang out and have some...
And go back to your swim.
we're not jealous. thanks for being on the show, James.
Thanks, James. Nice talking to you.
Okay. Have me on again.
We'll do.
Bye-bye.
So this is another episode where we fantasize being in tropical places.
But if zone 11.
Zone envy. If you have a story to share from your zone, get in touch and we will consider it for an episode or for our blog. The show was written and produced by Carmen DeVito and Alice Krieg. Please subscribe to our blog or check us out on Twitter at We Dig Plants to stay current on our projects and upcoming shows. Follow us on Instagram at WeDigPlants/GroundworksGardensNYC. Thanks for listening and see you in the virtual garden.
Next up, Zone 10.
Listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Aweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.